Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to episode number 76 of the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode, I am joined by my good friend, Nathaniel Drew. Nate is a pastor, he's an author, and he decided to go back to school to work on a degree in marriage and family therapy. So we talk about his faith journey, his leadership journey, and why emerging leaders would do well to get additional training outside of their primary area. It's a rich conversation that I'm sure you'll enjoy. So listen up. It is cold when you look at the weather across the country. I mean, it's just cold. I saw one of my friends on social media did the whole boiling water, throw it up in the air and watch it turn into snow thing in Chicago. And Chicago is like some ridiculous minus 50 degrees. I don't even know. It's crazy just how cold it is across the country. So we hope that you are bundled up and warm as you're listening to this episode of the Leading While Green podcast. And while you're bundled up, hey, head over to iTunes, head over to iTunes podcast and leave a 5-star review. Leave some comments. Let other people know about this Leading While Green journey that we are on together. If you have not checked out episode number 75, you want to check it out. It was a tough episode to record. It was an episode recorded in honor of my good friend, Dr. Michael Adu, who passed suddenly. And I got together with the guys on our mastermind group and we talked about our leadership journey and the impact that our good friend, Dr. Michael Adu had on our life. So I want you to check out that episode of the podcast. So on today's episode, I get to talk with my good friend, Nathaniel Drew, who is an author, who is a pastor. Man, he has a heart for people, and realized there were some gaps in his training, in his preparation for pastoral leadership and ministry. So he decided to go back to school and do a degree in marriage and family therapy. So we have a great conversation about his journey, what he's learned about leadership. We throw in some mental health and some family stuff in there, and it's a rich conversation. I know you're going to get a lot out of it, so I want you to pay careful attention. Here is my conversation with my good friend, Pastor Nathaniel Drew. I'm excited to be joined on this episode by my good friend. He's an author. He's a minister. He's currently working on his internship in marriage and family therapy, Nathaniel Drew. Nate, thanks for joining me.
Man, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
So, man, just take us back down memory lane. When would you say that you first recognized just how important it was to be a good leader? Was it in elementary school? Was it in high school? Was it in college? When did it make sense to you?
Man, honestly, if I'm going to go back, I would have to say the origin of it had to be my mother. As a single parent, you know, trying to instill in three boys and one girl, just this idea that it is always more advantageous to be a leader rather than to be a follower. Now with that, she also would, you know, would teach us this, you know, this idea and the important concept that you have to be able and even willing to follow in certain situations to even know how to lead. But it was probably her as the first person that just drilled in me the importance of being a leader, even when you are standing by yourself, when you're doing something that might not be popular amongst the crowd. Just being able to stand on your own two feet and to live, to lead, if that's the word you want to use, according to your moral compass, your belief system, and things like that. Now, I'm not going to lie and say that from an early age, I adopted what she was trying to instill in me, and I went with it because I didn't. I would absolutely categorize myself as a leader early on, even though I wasn't trying to be a leader. You know, people would would naturally, you know, follow me for good or for bad, just being honest. Mm-hmm. But I don't think at that point, elementary school, middle school, even high school, that I was looking at it in a sense that, man, I'm trying to be a leader. I need to be a leader so that people can follow me. I was just, you know, my own person. And so from a leadership standpoint, I don't even really think it clicked for me probably until the latter part of college, undergrad, and then into graduate school.
So do you think, just based on your personal experience, that we should start with kids in elementary school? With, 'cause you find a lot of programs now, like the Leader in Me program, Stephen Covey's principle, mm-hmm. the 7 Habits, that they're introducing into elementary school curriculum. Do you feel like we should have that emphasis on leadership in elementary school? Should we have it so early, or should we just let kids kind of naturally acclimate and introduce them to those principles as they get older?
Man, honestly, just my personal opinion is, you know, that it's always a risk if we say let's wait and let's let people develop and take the chance. There's always a chance that if we go that route, they could end up, you know, with it clicking, and then they learn how to be this awesome leader. But it could also just as easily go in the opposite direction. And so I always advocate for, you know, as early as possible, the better. So yes, you know, elementary school, you know, at young ages, just instilling in children, just the idea of what it takes to be a leader. And I think when you do it at a young age, then you have the greatest opportunity to, with leadership principles, also instill important things like integrity and honesty and being able to not be swayed by people's opinions, and to stand on your own 2 feet, and to live by truth and not lies. So all of these different things, I think, you know, are all included when we can get kids at an early age and try to instill. Maybe they won't take it as leadership then, but if we can just instill the principles, you know, beyond leadership, then when they get to an age and they develop into an age when they actually understand leadership, then I think it would be able to click, and they're better able to put those pieces together to be that kind of effective leader.
So there were some principles, some ideas that your mom shared with you and your brothers and sisters growing up. How did being introduced to those concepts help you make the decision to go into a pastoral ministry and pastoral leadership?
Great question, Pierre. One of the things that I've always appreciated about my mother was the fact that she never tried to force us to do what she felt we were called to do. I never once questioned whether my mother supported me, whether my mother loved me. And she knew that, you know, with there being 4 of us, that each of us, I mean, our personalities, our gifts, our talents, they differ just like our faces did. But she created this environment, and no, she wasn't perfect. No, the environment wasn't always perfect, but she created an environment that sort of fostered the gifts and talents that we had. And she put us in places where we could be most successful. And so for me, just the fact that she was able to instill, along with those kinds of principles that we talked about a little earlier. But one of the things that was very big in my home and in my family was our religious background. Seventh-day Adventist Christians. And so my mother did an awesome job of sort of cultivating, you know, the development of a personal relationship with Jesus. And I can remember when I was in 11th grade in high school, and I was sort of met with a dilemma. And you know, Pierre, as one of my good friends, that I love the game of basketball. I love basketball more than most things. And I wanted nothing more than to play basketball for my high school. But as it turned out, I went to a public school, and most of the games were on Friday night and Saturdays. For Seventh-day Adventist Christians, that's called our Sabbath. And so, you know, I went, I remember my 11th grade at my junior year, I was 16 years old. I felt like I was old enough to be able to make my own decision. And I went to my mom and I said, listen, you know, in no uncertain terms, I really want to play. I understand, you know, our background and our religious background, but this is something I really want to do. And I'll never forget what my mom said to me. She said, you know, you are 16 years old, and for the last 16 years, I have done my best to lead you, to parent you, to guide you as I felt the Lord would have me. And she said, I think you're at an age right now where everything you've learned, all the experiences you've gone through, where you are old enough and smart enough to be able to make the decision that you feel is best for you. So she said, I'm not going to make this decision for you. You feel like this is something you want to do, and you would rather forfeit, you know, the Sabbath in order to play basketball games. I'm going to allow you to make your own decision. Just know that when it comes to the games being on Sabbath, I won't be able to be there to support you, but every other day I'll be there to support you. Man, I could not believe that she gave me that option. And I went out of her room that day. Of course, I didn't smile or laugh when I was in the room, but I left out of there, man. I was the happiest I'd ever been in my life, because I feel like I just got the okay from my mom. And so I said, listen, I already know what my decision is going to be. I don't even got to think about it. I'm playing. The only obstacle I was thinking was my mom. And she took that roadblock out of the way. And man, at some point between when I went to bed that night and I went to tryouts the next day, you know, some people call it your conscience, the Holy Spirit, whatever it is, but it just didn't feel right to me to go forward with what I felt I wanted to do, knowing that I would have to compromise the principles, the beliefs, and everything that had been ingrained in me up to that point. And I was faced with a decision. I could either, you know, stand on my own two feet and live based on principle, or I could sort of fold and do just what I wanted to do, instant gratification. And I went to the coach, you know, and I said, listen, coach, I really want to play, but I'm really serious about my beliefs in God and my upbringing. And I just want to know if you allow me to play, but just not playing the games on Sabbath. And as hard as it was, you know, he looked at me and told me, you know, it wouldn't be fair to the rest of the team. I can't allow you to do that. And so, you know, that might seem like a small thing to most. And there is an actual story behind what led me into pastoral ministry. But even more than that, as incredible as I feel that story is, what's even bigger to me is just the trust and the belief that my mom had in me, where she said, I've done the best I could to ingrain in you certain principles and beliefs and allow for you to grow in your relationship with the Lord, but I cannot baby you for too much longer. You're 16, you're going into adulthood. You have to be able to make decisions on your own. And through that, man, I was able to make what I feel was the best decision for me. So my mom was very instrumental in the direction and trajectory that my life took.
So let's unpack this a bit more, especially when we're talking about younger professionals, and when we do training for younger professionals, we try to underscore things like integrity, like values, like belief, some of the principles that really undergirded your upbringing. What do you think is the challenge for many young professionals, regardless of disciplines or where they work, in adjusting to consequences? And I'm thinking, at 16, your mom is really saying to you, it's your choice, it's your decision, and you're going to have to shoulder the consequences. And part of the consequence is, I'm not going to be there to support you because based on my convictions. And sometimes we find in the emerging professionals that we deal with that they have a challenge with navigating or negotiating consequences. Where do you think that comes from?
Man, I honestly think that part of it is this fascination that we have, and maybe it's a generational thing, maybe not, but just this fascination that we have with instant gratification. And oftentimes, and I'm not gonna sit here and lie and act like the process I went through to make that decision at 16 years old, that I responsibly exercise that same willpower with every decision I've ever faced in life, because that would be a bold-faced lie. I have flopped and made, as you know, almost as many, if not more, bad choices than good ones. And so what I will say is that in a lot of the cases where I found myself making decisions that I had to pay for later, it was this fascination that I know I have with instant gratification, that I want what I want and I want it now. I don't want to be made to wait for it. I don't want to have to go through any kind of strife to get it. I want it now. And because of this idea and this fascination with now, you know, I want this moment now because I don't feel like I'll get a similar one or a better one later. That at least for me, it has caused me to maybe, you know, experience some gratification then, but that gratification, however big or small it might have been, always paled in comparison when I rushed it, always paled in comparison to the consequences that I faced later on. And so maybe not for everyone, but for a lot of us, I think this idea with having to face consequences later, having to pay the price for things later, really has to do with not being disciplined. That's a good word that I'll use, not being disciplined enough to make sound decisions, to make sound choices, to delay certain things, and to even go through the process of thinking about certain things and thinking down the line, how would this choice, however big or small, how would this choice affect me 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now? And because a lot of us don't possess that ability, then we end up having to face more consequences, I think, than are necessary.
So for those of you who are listening, conversation with Nathaniel Drew, we went to the same school for our theological training, for our graduate seminary work in preparation to be pastors. What would you say? How would you say Nate, this played out, this idea of instant gratification played out for you in your seminary studies, in your graduate degree? Because for a lot of us in the seminary and training to be professional pastors, there's this sense of, man, seminary is just getting in the way. Like, I just want it to be over so I can get out and, you know, be work full time and be a professional, and I'm ready now. Yeah. How did you negotiate those feelings?
Man, great. Another great question, man. Thinking back on my seminary experience, you know, and I laugh sometimes about it, but I would say that during the time of my graduate studies when I was in seminary, I had a love-hate relationship with preaching. Now, I knew that once I graduated, God willing, from seminary, that the very next step after that would be full-time pastoral ministry, where for a large part, you know, the work as a pastor would encompass preaching, right? And so I knew that that would come. And so the experiences that I got before I graduated from seminary to preach, you know, and you know this as well, you know, Pierre. Yes, they are high stress moments, especially the times where you're preparing for a message, you're preparing to preach. They can be high stress moments, and they take a lot of time and take a lot of effort, especially for those who work hard like you do to perfect your craft. You put a lot into it. But the flip side of that is that once you sort of get to that pinnacle moment where you're able to deliver what God birthed in you, you know, oftentimes there's no greater feeling of euphoria. I mean, you feel good. Yes, you know, you're grateful for what the Holy Spirit has done. But any preacher would tell you that there's also a sense of gratification. There's a sense of accomplishment. You know, when people are brought closer to the Lord as a result of you using your gift. So I say this to say that in the seminary, I had a very tough time because I made a personal decision that I was going to delay that sense of gratification to the point where I purposefully did not take as many, if any, speaking engagements. And that's not to say that they did not come. But for me, it was twofold. I felt like I needed to take full advantage of the time when I was at seminary to mentally, to physically, and to spiritually prepare for everything I was going to have to deal with after the seminary. So for me, the it was very difficult seeing a lot of my colleagues, seeing a lot of my friends who were going to Chicago and going to various places in Michigan and going to other states, some other countries, and they're preaching, and you see them on social media, and they're doing this and they're doing that while simultaneously doing their studies in school. And a lot of those times I would look at myself like, man, you know, I should be out there doing that. I should be perfecting my craft. I should be taking every opportunity that comes my way. But I said what I felt was the greater thing for me was to use that time to prepare, to learn. And so what shaped my seminary experience, and I tell people this all the time, was actually you, Pierre, was your wife and similar individuals who poured into me during that 2.5 year period where I just had mentor and friend after mentor and friend that poured into me and helped me with my training, that helped me with my gift. that helped me in areas that paid dividends once I got into pastoral ministry. So for me, I would say one of the areas of dealing with that whole instant gratification type thing was that I said to myself, listen, after the seminary, I'm going to have years, if God mm-hmm. gives them to me, years to mm-hmm. be able to use my gift to bless people. I would never be given a 2.5 year period where I'm not having to worry about leading a church. I'm not having to worry about leading a congregation. I'm not having to worry about putting a sermon together that opportunity again. So why don't I take it to hone my gifts, to train, to prepare so that I can reap the benefits from it later?
So even with that, even with taking this particular perspective on your graduate time and your seminary training, you have classes, you have mentors, you have friends, the people that can help encourage you and share some perspective for you.
Yeah.
For most of us, when we leave graduate school or we leave school or training or trade school or whatever, we notice that sometimes there is a disconnect between what we were learning in the classroom, what we were experiencing, and that environment, that almost vacuum-like experience for however long our training process was. And then when we get to the place where we're applying it, like full-time, all the time, in real time, what was that disconnect like for you? What was an experience that made you realize, man, like, I'm not in school anymore. Like, I'm pastoring full-time. And this thing is real. And I'm not quite sure if there was anything in the classroom or during that season of life that could have prepared me for this leadership experience.
Man, there's too many to count. But the first one that came to my the very first one that came to my mind is the very first sermon that I preached at my installation service when I was installed as the associate pastor at the Ethan Temple Seventh-day Church under Dr. Joe Greider. It was my installation sermon, very first one. And you remember what that's like, and just to mm-hmm. feel like you're ready, you're excited, but you're nervous at the same time. This is the very first one, and it's different from any other time we've preached before. It just feels different. And I remember I got up to preach that day, delivered the word as God gave it to me, and was satisfied with what the Lord had done. Felt like everything went well. And in that particular sermon, in order to drive a point home, but also to sort of connect with the real side of the congregation, I used a sentence from a song. So I used quoted a sentence of some lyrics from a song, and I can't even remember what the song is right now. But I quoted that in the message. So like I said, to drive the point home, but to also just appeal to the real side of people, to connect with that side of people, because I knew that they knew the song, and they did. And the congregation went with me. Most of them laughed. Others shouted out in agreement with whatever it was. But right after the sermon, man, I walk off the platform. We march to the back. We're going to be shaking hands, and I'm standing in the back. And a lady, and I noticed her. She was sitting toward the front. Older lady came to the back, and I'm mistaken. It was the next Sabbath, and we marched out the next Sabbath after my installation. I didn't preach that day, but she remembered the sermon the week before. And I'm standing in the back, and she comes. And she hands me a manila packet, and I'm sort of caught off guard because I'm trying to figure out, what it is. A pretty thick packet or envelope. And she says, Pastor Drew, I want you to read this, and I think it would help you. And she said, and I even went ahead and underlined or highlighted the things that I think would be most beneficial to you. And so I'm thinking to myself, what in the world could this be? I get home and I put my stuff down. I open up the folder. I bring out this packet, and in the packet, she puts on page one and highlights some words in the packet that talk about how secular music destroys people's minds and have no place in Christian hearts and things like that. And so I immediately knew what it was, or what the reason was that she gave me this packet. It was tied to the one sentence out of a 45-minute sermon that sort of drew her attention, which was those lyrics. And it sort of caused her to ignore everything else, even the context around it, but just zero in on that. She had an issue with that, and she wanted me to know she had an issue with it. And it was in that moment. I think I even called you and told you about that during that time. But it was in that moment that I said, this thing is for real now. We're not in the classroom. And it also alerted me to the fact that there was nothing in those 2.5 years of my seminary time that would prepare me for that. And it got real at that point, man. And I had to, that was the first of many experiences that just taught me how to deal with people.
You know, when we are in these classes and having these conversations and sort of a jaded view of what leadership in a local church context is like,
absolutely,
it kind of slaps you in the face when you get down to congregational leadership. Now, it's one thing for church members, for congregants to say, man, I wish pastors would know how to do X, Y, and Z. It's another thing for clergy, you know, for pastors to say, man, I really wish they had prepared us for X, Y, and Z. What are some of the things that you say after having worked and pastored for several years now, that if you could go back to your seminary experience, you say, man, I wish while we were in school, they would have talked about this more. I wish they would have underscored this. I wish they would have prepared us for this. Because when I got into it, I was blind and I didn't have any clue what I was getting into.
Man, again, way too many things to count. But, you know, but after being in pastoral ministry now going on 6 or 7 years, and just thinking about that question, our seminary experience, and for a large degree, even my experience at Oakwood as well, is very theological heavy. Heavy on theology. You're getting a lot of stuff on how to read the text and how to break down the text. You're learning your Greek and your Hebrew. You're learning about different theologians and what they've added to our history and learn about Adventist history and all these different things like that. And I'm not suggesting that those things don't have their place, because they absolutely do. But looking back on my experience, I just noticed that one of the areas that were lacking heavily, and I can only remember really one class that was sort of devoted to it. And even then, I remember feeling after the class was over, this was in no way sufficient. Our experience was not loaded with a lot of classes and with a lot of things that taught you how to deal with people, that taught you how to manage different personalities, that taught you that I can't talk to sister so-and-so the same way I talk to brother so-and-so, because she processes it much differently than he processes it. It doesn't teach us about how to manage generational gaps and how it's different being in a church where you have so many different generations represented, learning how to appeal to each one almost simultaneously, where if you appeal too much to the younger generation, the older generation feels some type of way, and then vice versa. There wasn't a lot of classes or experiences taught us how to handle conflict. When you have people in board meeting that are just one step away from going to blows, right? you know, it's not much that teaches you how to handle that. Or because I've had colleagues and I've had mentors that have told me about times in churches and in boards where they almost went to blows with one of their members. And so you're not really taught how to handle those situations. I don't remember too many classes that really walked us through how to give a board meeting, how to give a business meeting, how to vision cast, how to make connections with your local community, how to galvanize your church body and move them in a certain direction. There were no classes that prepared, you know, me for, you know, for that and how to handle that. How to have a conversation with somebody that's dealing with that. There was no such preparation for things like that. And so I just feel like, and I know 2.5 years is not a long time, but I feel like if that's the time that we're going to be given for our training, then I would much rather see a ratio where it was heavy on practicality and maybe a little less on theology, because we've gotten that so much from undergrad and going into it. And so, you know, I'm not here to criticize the experience, but I do feel like if it was not for my experience with my senior pastor when I was an associate, if it were not for my mentors and friends like you and others, that I would have been far behind the eight ball when I got to a church on my own.
No, it's interesting. And much of our conversation hasn't been about the church space. But when I travel and I talk to leaders who are not necessarily faith-based or working for faith-based organizations, you find the same things. Their training, their college degrees taught them how to be proficient in this one particular area. But most of my training on leadership is around the same conflict resolution, how to mobilize your team, how to cast vision in your organization, what to do across generations. You have a mixed workplace of baby boomers, Gen X, and millennials, and how to get everybody to work together. So we really see across disciplines how you know, our training programs really hunker down on one particular area, but then they leave us exposed in other areas.
Absolutely.
So for you, you said, okay, you know, there's some areas of exposure for me in my leadership capabilities, and you decided to take a further step and not just kind of sit on that or gripe about it, but you took a proactive step to acquire some additional training. Talk to us about how you came to that decision in the area that you're training in.
Honestly, man, it came about, I would say, in two different ways. One, because it was birthed out of a passion that I feel God has placed on my heart. But secondly, man, it was because I feel like I was bamboozled once I got into my leadership context. And I say I feel like I was bamboozled because when we are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed undergrad students, or even some seminary students, and we're in school and we're learning and different things like that. And if there are any theology students that are listening to this, I would caution you to listen very closely, because what we are tricked into thinking is that the greatest part, or the biggest part of I'll say pastoral ministry, because that's the field that I'm in, is preaching. And so what do a lot of us do as students? We pour our greatest emphasis, time, and energy into what we feel will be the biggest part of what we're going to be doing once we leave school. And so for many of us, we've been bamboozled into thinking that that is preaching. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not lessening the effect or impact of preaching, because all of us who are pastors know that is a huge part of it. It's a huge way to galvanize your church, to move your church and progress your church. But I was very stunned and surprised when I got into a church context to learn that is not at all the greatest part of what it means to be a pastor. Because once you get into that thing, you realize that there's an expectation that the people have, one, that you know what you're doing as a leader. So there's an expectation that they have that you're going to be able to take them and lead them from where they are to where they need to be. There's an expectation that when people go into the hospital, many times, not only that you'll visit them, but that you'll just magically be able to know when they go into the hospital and then go visit them.
Magically.
So then there's that expectation. Then you have the expectation that from your family that you'll be able to navigate being there for your spouse, and if you have them, being there for children, and not just be, you know, being looked at as a hero at church, but being able to be looked at as a hero at home. There's an expectation that you'll automatically know how to navigate the different feelings and personalities of people, given the trauma, given all of the experiences they've had in their life that they all carry into the church. So we have all of these things. And when I got into it, one of the first things I realized is, wow, I have been bamboozled, because pastoral ministry is not just about preaching. So once I shook that shock off, Then I said, what can I do to better prepare me to meet the demands that would come from being in this field? And the path and journey that God took me on was in the route of mental health. And I'm a huge advocate for mental health, for mental wellness, because I believe that when people are made whole, and I'm talking about the home, because our churches are made up of various homes that are represented in the church. So if we can somehow help to heal and somehow we can help to put back together the different homes that are represented in our church, then we'll see greater healing. We'll see greater progress in our actual church. Because all the church is full of people who bring all of their drama, all of their hurts, all of their pains, all of their trauma from their home experience into one location and one pastor. In most cases, if you're gifted to have an associate, praise the Lord. But in most cases, one man, one woman is put in one building with hundreds of different experiences, traumas, and drama and different things that have taken place. And they're expected to not only navigate those things, but to galvanize them in a way that progresses the church. And so for me, I felt like the Lord birthed in me a passion for seeing broken families and people made whole again. And I would go as far as to say, and I've heard this, I don't remember who said it, but I read once that oftentimes your greatest passion comes from your deepest hurt. And so for me, as someone who grew up in a broken home, where my parents were divorced at an early age from my siblings and me, and not having a relationship with our father, it shattered not just my own self, my own existence, but that of my siblings as well. And it was during the process of my wife and I going through pre-engagement counseling with Dr. David Sedlacek, one of the greatest therapists I've ever met in my life, going through that experience that sort of brought out of me this passion that I feel God had already placed in me to see broken people and broken families made whole. And so I decided that I would go the route of mental health and to pursue an academic journey in marriage and family therapy, but I believe that added emphasis would help me to navigate the various people groups, personality types, and the trauma that I would be dealing with on an everyday basis at church.
Now, that's worked and it is working out for you in this sort of marriage, this complementary relationship between pastoral ministry and marriage and family therapy. What's your advice to other young professionals? These are not their arenas, but they're looking for some additional training. Like they're thinking, okay, maybe I should do an MBA. Maybe I should do a certificate program. But on one side, people are like, why? You know, you're trained, you have a career. Why do you need this additional training? But there's something inside of them. They feel like this nudge that they need to sharpen up or gain more tools or more training in a different area.
Yes, I say absolutely, absolutely do it. I don't think anybody can be too prepared. And oftentimes what my experience has been is that the people, and a lot of times, you know, whether you're a pastor in a church, whether you're a leader in another organization, sometimes a lot of the individuals who will sort of say things that will put hindrances in your path. Well, why do you need that? You don't necessarily need to do that. You already have a certain level of training for this job. And oftentimes what I've seen is that people really want to know, even if they don't use it, they want to know that they have a monopoly on your time. And for people to hear that you're going to use your time, whatever free time you have left, not to devote to the organization, not to devote to the church, not to devote to the business, but to devote to the betterment of yourself, people can't handle that sometimes. Because if you emphasize yourself, then that's less emphasis for me. And so I had to get to a point where I stopped feeling guilty about bettering myself. Because even with the people who might be trying to talk me out of it, in the long run, this is going to help you, right? So in my sphere or in my field, I would encourage people, absolutely, you don't have to go to mental health route. But as you mentioned, there are business degrees that people can get. there are technology degrees that people can get. I've had colleagues who started out in pastoral ministry, but felt like they were called to do things in IT and technology. And now they're in organizations and they're in conferences and in different places of business where they're leading, the tech aspect for those companies. So you never know where God is trying to take you. You never know what kind of gifts you possess that are hidden. And if we don't take the time to cultivate, if we don't take the time to better ourselves, if we don't take the time to read, if we don't take the time to develop, then we will be sitting on talents and gifts that God has given us, that there's an expectation that we use, but because of fear, because of intimidation, because we allow people to sway us, we're going to sit on those things and allow them to go to waste. I just made a determination that that's not going to be my story.
So give us an example, and as we get to the end of this conversation, give us an example of how your training, now you're dead in the middle of your internship with marriage and family therapy. Give us an example of how this training, this coursework, these experiences have benefited you, maybe in your own marriage, maybe in your pastoral role, or with friends and colleagues. How has it been an asset and a benefit to you?
Man, I'm going to, and not even in an attempt to sound selfish, but I would say that I have benefited probably the most from the added experience and training that I've had. And then I've also seen benefits in my place of business. One of the things that I feel my learning experience has taught me is how broken I really am. And yeah, we say that. We say, I'm not perfect. I'm a work in progress. I'm under construction, whatever kind of phrases we want to attach to it. Mm-hmm. But going through this experience has really opened my eyes to how broken I still am as a pastor, as a mental health student, as someone who people look to for guidance and look to for support. I had to admit to myself that I'm broken. And so one of the first ways that I've seen it just help me and blossom me was to get myself into counseling and therapy. I had to say to myself, how in the world can I advocate for people seeking to, seeking wellness and seeking therapy and seeking counseling if I'm too proud to admit that I need it myself? So the first thing that I realized in my own life and in my own marriage, because my wife and I often mention that, the first year of our marriage that people normally attribute to being the most difficult year of marriage, that was a breeze for us. Really years 1 through 3 were a breeze to the point where we were asking ourselves, are we doing something wrong because we're not struggling enough? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until earlier this year, right? I would say the latter part of last year, but coming into this year, where we sort of reached the height of disagreement and conflict and struggle, where we had to really just sift through and work through some things to the point where we said, listen, we need to go get some help. And the fact that I've been able to be in this training helped me to fight off this stigma that seeking help or going to therapy means you're crazy. Going to therapy means you're giving up. Going to therapy means that you don't have what it takes. No, all of that is garbage. It has benefited me because I've dropped my pride and taken part in it. And I've also seen it reap benefits in my place of business, where when I would say 3 couples in this first year that I've been in my church have come to me for marriage counseling. And I've been able to implement a lot of the principles, a lot of the techniques that I've learned throughout my academic journey, where I'm not just shooting from the hip and I'm trying to figure out what to do, but I actually have some background and some actual training to help me help them. And so those are 2 ways that I've seen the most benefit so far in my seeking further education and development.
Nate, I call this section of the podcast shameless plug time. So if you got any social media links, websites, what GPS coordinates, whatever, if we want to stay connected to you, what's the best way to do that?
Absolutely. You know, through the outlets on social media, I'm on Facebook, Nathaniel Henry Drew, on Instagram, Nathaniel H. Drew. You can find me there. I'm also on Twitter with my name as well, Nathaniel Drew. I just came out with my website earlier this year, NathanielHDrew.com. And so you can feel free to hit me up on there. I have some blog posts on there, some ways you can obtain my book while you're waiting. God's Not Yet is not a no. And I also just want to mention for any pastors that may be listening, especially younger pastors, I'm right now working on my second book, 15 Ways to Make a Big Impact in a Small Church. And so that'll be coming out next year. And I ask for your prayers on that. But feel free to hit me up. I'd love to stay in contact with anybody that would love to be in contact with me.
My guest today has been author, minister, and intern in the area of family and marriage therapy, Pastor Nathaniel Drew. Thanks for joining me, man. I appreciate our time, and I know our audience will be better for it.
Man, thank you very much for having me. It was a blast.
Great conversation with my friend, Pastor Nathaniel Drew, and we packed a lot into that episode. We talked about family, we talked about faith, we talked about mental health and leadership and some lessons that he has learned on his journey. Check him out. I put his information in the show notes, his website, his social media. Get a copy of his book if you're looking for a devotional. It's a great devotional book to read. And just keep tracking what Nate is doing in the space of pastoral ministry and marriage and family therapy. Hey, that's all I got for this episode of the Leading While Green podcast. Hop over to iTunes, leave me that 5-star review, leave some comments, let people know about this Leading While Green journey. That's all I got for this episode. So until next time, take care and God bless.